This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
And good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us here on Tactics, whether you're watching us on Facebook, YouTube, Periscope, Twitch. We appreciate you being here. We're thankful that you're here. And, you know, this is the place, and we have the motto, we really believe in it. This is the place where disagreement is not hatred. And though there's that's really what I want to zero in on today. Because it happens every single time, and I've done this speech before, so I'm not going to go into great detail. But a lot of you that are watching right now probably are watching expecting to see some political commentary. I have a 48-hour rule. I don't give any political commentary on shootings until 48 hours after they've actually taken place. And so because of that, the shootings, I'm not going to give a rundown on the political talking points because I believe that the families deserve it. The very least, I think the bare minimum that we can do is 48 hours without trying to use the death of their family members as a political football or talk about the finer points of what kind of political points we can score based on a tragedy. And I actually do this not just with tragedies involving human violence. I even do it with natural disasters. If there is a natural disaster, for example, a big hurricane that comes through, I don't use it to make a political point until 48 hours afterward. Now, I may talk about the facts and the details about it, but I don't actually get into my opinions or the way that I think that it's going to politically play out for somebody until at least 2 days after that is taking place. And what has been absolutely devastating the past week is that we have had such an abundance of mass shootings. Now, there's a couple of important things to remember to keep this into context. Mass shootings are absolutely horrible, but they are also exceedingly rare. They get a lot of news coverage in part because they are rare. If there were mass shootings that were happening every week, people would stop reporting on them because they'd be commonplace. They wouldn't really be news. And so one thing that is important to remember that you're seeing everybody talk about it, you're seeing all this controversy, whether you're watching news on the internet, news on your broadcast stations, news on the big alphabet soup networks, on cable news, whatever you're watching it on, just remember that any news at all is there specifically because it's not a common occurrence. Because if it were a common occurrence, there would be no reason to cover it in the news. So just be aware of that. And another thing that I want to kind of pace people for and help them to understand exactly what's going on to help give you a little bit of perspective. Mass shootings are a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of the violent gun deaths in this country. We actually do have even though it's been on the decline for a long time, there is gun violence in this country that is a much bigger problem than mass shootings. Again, the reason they garner so much attention is because they are, by their very nature, incredibly rare. And so, of all the deaths we have in this country every day, a very small fraction of them are violent gun deaths, and a very small fraction of that small fraction is mass shootings. So I'm in no way trying to dismiss the conversation. I'm not saying it's not a conversation we should have. I wouldn't be spending the vast majority of my show today talking about them if it were not for that. I'm just saying that let's remember to keep things in perspective and be aware of the fact that even though, yes, this is a problem, yes, this is something that we need to deal with and we can have that conversation, I think it's a beneficial conversation to have. Let us also remember that this is not something that is some kind of outrageous epidemic that's going to be something that falls down on top of us anytime soon. I'm not even saying that in reaction to anything anybody has said, even though I could have. I'm just sort of generally putting it out there that let's remember to put this in its proper perspective, that even though this is a real issue and that there are real talking points surrounding it that are important to hash out, it's also important to remember that if you're comparing this to something, for example, like heart disease, it's a pretty small percentage. Or cancer or any of the other things. We know there's hardly anybody in this world, in this country, that has not lost one, if not several, loved ones to cancer. How many loved ones have you lost to mass shootings? Now, of course, that's an anecdotal answer, and occasionally you'll find somebody that has lost more people to mass shootings than cancer. But my point is, the vast overwhelming majority of the population has had a lot of experience with somebody that they know going through something like heart disease or cancer, and then you compare that to mass shootings, it's a very small percentage. So let's just remember that when we're watching the news about it. And I want to go over some of the details here because I do think that it's important. El Paso, shooting that occurred a little bit further back, not the most recent shooting because the one in Dayton, Ohio occurred, I believe, 13 hours afterward. In El Paso, Texas, the body count now has risen to 20. So 20 are dead and a little over 24 injured. We don't have an exact number on that yet. And this is another advantage of waiting 24 hours to really delve into it, is that we have details by that point. So about over 25, or about 24, 25 injured. We're not sure of the exact numbers there. And one thing that is really odd about this is that, as rare as all of these shootings are, we've had four of them in 1 week, North California at the Garlic Festival, and then in Mississippi, then in Texas, and then this last one in Ohio. One thing that's really odd about this El Paso shooting is that it took place in a Walmart, which is not necessarily a place that you normally see these kinds of shootings. It's really, really bizarre that even though Walmart is not exactly a common place for school shootings, not nearly as common, for example, as, you know, a school or just some kind of public venue, you know, a bar, a street, something like that. There have been shootings in Walmarts before, but they're not a super common occurrence. And it's really odd that of these four mass shootings that took place in the span of a week, you had one in Mississippi in a Walmart and another one in another Walmart in Texas. That's very odd, very much outside the norm, but that is what is going on here. So it did occur in a Walmart, and seven Mexican citizens were killed, which is also very uncommon, but look at the location. El Paso is a city where a large part of the people that go back and forth from that city have green cards, they have visas, they can go back and forth. And you have a large population of people there that have immigrated as well. And so because of that, a lot of the people living in El Paso are not American citizens. Even the ones that are legal may still be Mexican citizens. They just happen to be working in the United States and doing so through legal means. We don't know about the status, the legal status of the seven people out of the 20 that were killed that were Mexican citizens. But the point is, of that group, seven of them happen to be Mexicans, legally Mexican citizens. But here's the part where it gets a little bit fuzzy, and this is always the way that it goes with these shootings, is that it takes them a little time to sort of unpack everything and really get down to the motives. But in this one, they think, even though they're afraid that they may be jumping the gun a little bit, they think that they've actually figured out what the motive behind this shooting is, because they believe that the shooter is the one that posted a racist manifesto which talked a lot about white nationalism and all kinds of other just hideous, grotesque stuff, and that that was the motive for killing someone. They believe that he may have posted this just a couple of hours before the shooting took place, which would in no way be, in no way at all, are they certain of it. And you'll remember that in past shootings, there were cases of mistaken identity where they tried to attribute motives where they got it wrong. And so this is something just to keep the eye on. I'm not saying that it isn't the same guy. I'm just saying that the police are using this as a lead. The lead may check out. It may not. If I had to guess, based on the information that I've seen, I would probably tend to believe that this is true. I'm saying just don't take that as fact just yet. Keep an eye on it. If it turns out to be that, okay. If not, that's okay too. Just follow wherever the facts go. So it may be motivated by white nationalism. We've seen attacks based on that before. You'll remember the Emanuel Church in the Carolinas, the shooting that took place there where 9 black individuals were shot inside a church. You'll remember that we had the attack that, thankfully, it's frankly a miracle more people weren't hurt in this one, in the alt-right white nationalist Klan rally that happened in Charlottesville a couple of years ago. There was one person run over by a car. And so they, you know, this is not unheard of. It is not as though there have never been attacks by white nationalists in the United States before. It's entirely possible. We'll just have to see. If I had to guess, this is probably going to wind up being true. And if so, and this is the way that the federales are handling it, the FBI is investigating it right now, believing that it may actually be a domestic terrorism case, which, if it's white nationalists, that is a political movement, therefore it would be a terrorism case. And I do think it's kind of odd. Some of the responses that I've seen either on the internet have been people that are upset that you're not calling out, you know, certain motives on that. It's really odd, and I don't want to get too deep into it because, like I said, it's very soon after this attack. But I don't know of anybody that doesn't refer to white national terrorism as terrorism, because I've heard so many allegations that it's racially motivated, that you'll call certain people terrorists and certain people not terrorists. I think that one of the arguments I actually got into on the air with a caller was, it was a while ago, back when I was on the terrestrial signal every day on News Radio 1440, and they said, well, how come you don't call this person a domestic terrorist? And I responded with, because he didn't have political motivations. And so terrorism is not just any kind of mass shooting. Mass shooting certainly can be domestic terrorism, and if this checks out, this probably is one. I think that it's appropriate that the FBI is investigating this as though it were a domestic terrorism case, because it very well may be. But we'll just have to wait and see, and the investigators will do their job and figure that out. So regardless of what the motive is, if you have any kind of political motivation behind a killing, in other words, you're doing the killing in an attempt to make a political statement, well, then obviously that's domestic terrorism. We saw that with the softball shooting. We've seen that with the Navy Yard shooting. We've seen it with Fort Hood. All of those things are cases of domestic terrorism. It doesn't necessarily have to be Muslims. San Bernardino would be domestic terrorism, for example. But there are other cases of domestic terrorism. The only requirement there is that it must be perpetrated with the intention of creating some kind of political change. Even eco-terrorists would fall under this umbrella, even though there's not many of them that cause a whole lot of deaths, but, you know, it does happen. And so it's 100% appropriate for the FBI to be investigating this as though it were a domestic terrorism case. And luckily, they do have the suspect in custody. So they're not still looking for him. The guy's not still at large. They do have the suspect in custody right now. But I don't, like I said, want to talk about the political fallout of this just yet, because I think it's too soon. But one thing that I have no hesitation whatsoever in talking about right now are the heroes. And they're really the ones that people should be focusing on anyway. Just like when you see some kind of natural disaster, where you see, for example, a hurricane or wildfires, mudslides or whatever, you will start seeing the media actually cover, and they've done so in this case too. I'm not trying to bash the media here, even though I do that on a pretty regular basis on this program. You'll see the media start coming out and talking about the heroes of that. When, for example, when Hurricane Harvey came through, they were talking about the Cajun Navy going down there and using their boats to try to help people. Same thing here. Same thing here. The people that we should be focusing on are the heroes. And to really understand this particular hero, because it is an amazing story, this woman who was just going to Walmart to buy school supplies for her daughter, she and her husband, thank God it appears as though the little girl was not there. She and her husband go into a Walmart, and then something that they would have never in a million years suspected was going to happen to them, especially in El Paso, which is one of the safer cities in America, according to several crime stats. In an El Paso Walmart, they hear gunfire. And her immediate reaction, the first thing that she starts thinking about, is the baby in her arms. Because Jordan Chondo had a 2-month-old, just became a new mom. Now, at this point, 2 months old, I mean, she's barely even gotten to know her baby. Hasn't started talking, hasn't taken its first steps. I mean, at this point in the childhood, that kid depends on her for absolutely everything. And this little 2-month-old child was protected and shielded from the bullets of some crazed lunatic by his mom. And sadly, because her husband Andre was there too, he died alongside his wife. This child is now an orphan at 2 months old. And the reason that they were there is to buy school supplies for their 5-year-old daughter, his big sister. The couple had just recently celebrated their 1-month anniversary, or their 1-year anniversary. And so now, they leave behind a 5-year-old little girl, probably starting school for the very first time, and her 2-month-old baby brother. But as horrible as that is, and as gut-wrenching as this story is to have to convey, I think that it's important for us to understand that she did exactly what a mom is supposed to do. Granted, this is a choice that I wouldn't wish on anybody. I would hope that nobody has to show this kind of bravery. When they hear something like that, and instead of trying to protect themselves or flee for their own life, their immediate response is to do everything they can to keep their 2-month-old alive. I wouldn't wish that decision on anybody. But in this baby's case, he is incredibly lucky that he had parents that loved him enough to lay down their lives to protect his. A 2-month-old baby that will never know what his parents were like. He won't be able to remember them. And as horrible as that is, and as much as I wish that their son could grow up with his mom and his dad, there is one thing he will know about them. No matter what happens, no matter their failings, no matter their imperfect nature as human beings, and I'm sure that he'll hear a lot about them from his relatives as he grows up. But there is one thing that that baby will always know. My parents loved me enough to give up their life for me. And as much as I'm sure that he would rather have his parents there for him to raise him, that kid is never going to have to wonder if he was worthy or whether or not he was loved. Because his mom gave the ultimate sacrifice to protect her child. And as the Gospel of John reads, there is no greater love than to lay down your life for another. And so we absolutely commend her, and she did her job. She answered the highest calling. Now, we don't know about the dad so much, about the details of what happened to him. For all we know, he would have shielded his son and just wasn't given the opportunity or was struck down beforehand. But what I do ask is that you pray for all the victims, but say a special prayer for this little boy and his big sister, who now have lost both their parents in the most horrific and tragic way imaginable, but also in a way that they are going to know growing up that their parents died heroes, that their parents were willing to put their own life on the line for theirs. And even though it is a greater blessing to live and grow up with your parents, caring for you and raising you and loving you, if you can't have your parents, it is a blessing to know that about them. And unfortunately, there are other families that are being afflicted by this as well. So say a special prayer for all those involved, but especially this family who have lost two of their family members. And in Dayton, Ohio, is the most recent shooting where 9 have died and 21 have been injured. So luckily not as deadly as the shooting in El Paso, but pretty bad. And this one did not occur in a Walmart. It occurred in a lively nightlife district, which happened at about 1 a.m. So if you were to look at a mass shooting that was most similar to this one, it would probably be Pulse Nightclub, where it happened really late at night. It was at a place where people tend to gather. That's probably what's going on here. And we do know that he used a 223 caliber rifle. So this would be something, it seems as though it's, they would have reported if it were an AR-15. So it's probably not in the AR platform, but it's something that uses the same ammo. So it's effectively that. In a lot of ways, because, you know, if you get hit by a bullet, it really doesn't matter what rifle or shotgun or wherever, whatever was used. If it's the same ammo, it really doesn't matter what kind of gun it came out of to you, because you get injured exactly the same either way. But it was also, according to reports, they had a 100 drum magazine attached to it. That's just what I'm seeing right here. As far as we know so far, the firearms in question were purchased legally. So this isn't a case of somebody stealing a firearm to use for their own use. Apparently, these both were his guns. This actually is reminiscent of the theater shooting in Louisiana, where we had a guy that just had absolutely no criminal record whatsoever, had no reason to believe that he would need to be banned from buying guns, and because of that, he was able to purchase them. The records show that he purchased them and got both from a federal licensed firearm dealer. So he got his guns through the legal process, and it wasn't as though the process failed like it did, for example, in Parkland. As far as we know so far, there was no government failure. It was just they checked his record and there was nothing to find. So he was able to purchase his firearm not because of some kind of government error. He was able to purchase it just because there was nothing in his record that would suggest that he would do something like this. And one thing that is also incredibly tragic about this one is that the gunman killed his own sister, evidently. That she is one of the 9 deaths in this, and she apparently rode with him, was in the car with him that they used to drive to the site of the shooting. So I don't know if she got shot accidentally by her brother or he rode there with her, because I mean the guy was wearing a bulletproof vest and tactical gear and had the firearm with him. She had to know that something was going on. You don't just jump into a car to go hang out with your sister and have all that on. So I don't know if she was an accomplice or what, but that's again something we're going to have to find out as more details continue to drop. But they did search his house, they searched his dwelling, and they found some papers that gave them a hint to the motivation, but the only motivation that they could find is that he seemed to only want to kill indiscriminately. And because of that, they are not ruling out that this could be domestic terrorism, but they also do not believe that it is. In fact, the police chief in a conference said that to say that it was domestic terrorism or that it was somehow politically or racially motivated would be jumping the gun. So right now, they have no reason to believe any of that. This seems to be just a psychopath that wanted to kill people, which if he murdered his own sister, that would kind of lean towards that. If you just want to kill and don't care who you're killing, then that would certainly fit the details of the story as we understand them so far. I really have no idea what the backstory is on that, and no one else does either right now. I would hate to think that his sister was betrayed by him, that she was thinking that he wasn't going to hurt her and then he did. Or we could also have a hostage situation. That's also possible. Like, maybe she didn't think that he was going to do that, but he jumped in the car, held a gun to her head, made her drive where he said to drive, and then killed her right there on the scene. That's also a possibility. So we just don't know a whole lot about that right now. But tragically, his own sister, what kind of absolute piece of human filth would be willing to do that to his own flesh and blood? I mean, it's horrible enough that he would indiscriminately shoot a gun into random strangers he didn't know, but to have the gall to kill your own family member like that, I don't understand how you can get to that level. Of course, I don't understand how you can get to the level of being a mass shooter anyway, but even further than that, to kill somebody that you have been that close to for so much of your life. But again, I think the important thing to focus on is the heroes. And in this case, the heroes absolutely were the police officers involved. Reports show that the police officers, it only took them 30 seconds after this gunman opening fire to take him down. So when he opened fire, tragically, he was able to do quite a bit of damage. But the police officers were able to take him down, even despite the fact that he was wearing a bulletproof vest, and I'm fascinated to hear how that shook out. But even though he was wearing protection for that kind of thing, the police officers still had the ability to take him down pretty quickly. And so we are incredibly grateful to our brave, heroic first responders and police officers for doing a good job, because if they hadn't been there right away, there is no telling what kind of damage this guy could have done. And so, you know, every bit of props to the Dayton police officers for being able to take this guy down in such a short amount of time. So evidently, President Trump is going to make a statement about this, and we are going to keep our eyes and ears open to see if that's going to take place. So for any political commentary, how this all shakes out, you'll just go ahead and check back tomorrow. Now, on this kind of same thread, there is some political back and forth going on here, and I just wanted to kind of go meta here for just a second. Let's not talk about the shooting itself or the details, or talk about, you know, gun control or trying to reinstitute insane asylums or any of that. I'm not going to get into policy, like I've said, but I do think it's interesting to bring this up, because I think that actually Senator Doug Jones makes at least a decent point here. And if you had woke me up this morning and said, "Hey, Caleb, guess what? You're actually going to give Senator Jones a compliment today," I would have laughed in your face. But I actually do think that he, I wouldn't say hits the nail on the head, because there's still some stuff that I wouldn't necessarily agree with. But Doug Jones put out a series of tweets in response to the shooting. And we'll see if we can go ahead and get those up. There they go. And this is the thread that he posted. "It has happened again, twice, two mass shootings in less than a day. The last I heard, there were 29 innocent people dead. I am at a loss for words as we mourn the victims, these two horrific crimes, but one thing is clear. Our government is failing in the most basic responsibility it has to the people of this country, to keep them safe. Most folks will, again, instinctively go to their corners and talk about guns, which is clearly a discussion that needs to continue. But this failure is about more than guns. Our failure to protect people is more pronounced today, given the early reports of racial motivations behind the shooting in El Paso. Unfortunately, that seems to be the tone that has been set in this country. We must come together and reject political rhetoric, or any kind of rhetoric for that matter, that divides us and stokes this kind of hatred. Our leaders need to set a positive example that others can follow. That, my friends, is something we can do now." So, first off, There are a couple points of contention. For example, he starts out by saying the government failed to protect the people. Well, I don't know if that's necessarily true, because like I said, and you just heard me go through some of the details of these two mass shootings, if you're looking through it, there's no indication that in either case the government failed to protect people. In fact, in the case of Dayton, Ohio, the police officers were there incredibly fast and were able to shut this guy down because they arrived apparently on scene only 20 seconds after he had opened fire and then took him down within 10 seconds. So a 30-second response taking the guy out, that's pretty good. And when it comes to the shooting in El Paso, like we said, there was no reason to believe that this guy had a prior, or at least not that we know so far, maybe that could change. There was nothing indicating that there was a failure on government's part. We've had mass shootings where that was the case. Parkland is a perfect example of that, where we find out that there was some kind of inconsistency or some kind of problem in the system, and for whatever reason, the government at some level didn't do its job, or at several levels in the case of Parkland. But thus far, there is no indication that that is going on. And so, while I don't think that it's outside the realm of possibility, this is another case of the government failing to protect the people the way that they're supposed to. Right now, we don't have evidence for that. And so I think that it is incorrect for Senator Jones to suggest that that is the case when, thus far, he has no reason to believe that. And another thing that I think that it's jumping the gun, even though there's more evidence for this than the last point, is that he talks about race being part of the motivation. It very well could be. And this is the thing that, again, I'm not going to delve very deep into it, but if you're looking at El Paso, Texas, white people are the minority, and there are a ton of Mexican citizens living there. So the fact that a lot of Mexican citizens got shot, not all of them were Mexican citizens, so there's also that question. But the fact that a lot of people of Mexican descent and Mexican citizens got shot is not indicative of the race. Now, if we find out that guy is the one that penned the manifesto on the internet beforehand, okay, we can be pretty sure that that was racially motivated if that's the case. This guy is pretty clearly a white nationalist, and that was what was driving his act. But we don't know that for sure yet. And so I think that it would have been far wiser for Doug Jones to leave that out of his analysis, at least until it's something that can be proven. And as somebody that has a legal background, Doug Jones ought to know that, especially with somebody like Doug Jones, who has spent a decent amount of his life specifically working in cases of race. But anyway, that's Doug Jones' takeaway. And so there are a couple points where I disagree with Doug Jones. I think he was jumping the gun on part of it. However, I do think that his main point about priorities and the priorities being hate and rhetoric are actually correct. I think that even though Doug Jones is no friend to gun rights or the Second Amendment, and that's been shown, his first speech from the Senate floor was about how we need stricter gun control. And so again, I'm not going to get into the finer points. I'm not going to debunk them. I don't think this is the appropriate time for that. But this is not to say that all of a sudden, hey, Doug Jones is an NRA guy. No, I'm not saying that at all. I know that he and I do not see eye to eye when it comes to gun rights and gun control. But I do want to give credit where credit is due. And I think that him saying that, okay, instead of just rushing to our corners and talking about guns and calling it a day, why don't we at least look at some of these other contributing factors? So instead of just blaming Republicans, which a lot of Democrats, a lot of his colleagues are doing, he's saying, let's look at the underlying cause of this. It's the hatred that people have in their hearts. It's this divisive rhetoric that's going on, this division that we're having in our country that is driving a wedge between people. And that is a contributing factor to why we're seeing these kinds of racist, evil-motivated hate crimes. And again, I'm someone that doesn't think hate crime legislation is a thing, because all crimes of a violent nature are hate crimes. But you understand what I'm saying. And I understand what Doug Jones is saying is that let's treat the cause, not the symptoms. So I think that that was his overall point, and I actually do want to give him a compliment for doing that, because that is really what the problem is. And this is somebody that even a hardcore Democrat like Doug Jones, who absolutely believes in gun control and actually has a 0% rating from the NRA right now, that he can come out and say, look, I'm not saying that we shouldn't talk about guns, but I do think that there are more important issues. And that is a unifying message, regardless of whether you like Doug Jones or like me, really don't like Doug Jones. There is a sense of unification there that, hey, yes, this is a real issue, but can we please talk about something that actually unites us? Can we please get to the root of the problem and treat that before we start jumping into our separate corners and just throwing punches at each other? That's a good place to start. And I think that one of the big problems that we have had in this country when it comes to momentum moments like this is that both sides, to a great degree, are unwilling to have an honest conversation and at least try to find some common ground. Because while it's absolutely correct, again, I'm not going to get too deep into the politics on this, but while it's absolutely correct that you have the left who wants all kinds of strict gun control and the right who typically wants little to no gun control, that's something that we can't agree on and haven't agreed on for a really long time. And again, I'm not saying we don't have that conversation, but why don't we have a more productive conversation, at least for a while, on things that we can agree on? Taking preventive measures that nobody would object to. You see, if you can't find the common ground, it's more fruitful to prioritize the other conversation so that some movement can take place, and then you can worry about the things that are more divisive, the things that you have a harder time reaching some consensus on. And that is a wise place to go. Because that's part of the reason that we have individual bills and we don't, you know, decide all of our laws at once. Is that you can take one issue that more people are likely to agree with, reforming the mental health facility and the way that that's run. Why don't we focus on those things that the average person can get on board with and then worry about the things that we don't have much agreement on later? I think that that's a smarter place to come from. And I did want to address this too, because I think that this is happening as well. And you remember that I said just a few minutes ago that if you told me this morning that I was going to be giving Doug Jones a compliment, that I would have laughed in your face. Well, I would have probably doubled that if you had told me that I was going to side with Doug Jones against Yellowhammer. Full disclosure, I really like Yellowhammer. I use them as a reference on my show on many, many occasions. There's a lot of good people down there, and the guy that authored this piece, I really like. His name is Sean Ross. I think that he's a brilliant writer. I've used his pieces over and over again. He and I see eye to eye on virtually everything when it comes to where the policy actually comes out. Somebody that I really admire, somebody that I appreciate. But this is one issue where I think he overstepped a bit, and I don't think that he's a horrible person or that he's responsible for dividing the country or anything like that. I'm just saying that here's a little constructive criticism from a friend. So this was the headline that Yellowhammer ran, this piece by Sean Ross. So you can see there, Doug Jones blasts the tone that has been set in this country after El Paso Dayton shootings. Headline, not misleading at all. That is an accurate reading of what happened with Doug Jones. He did, you just saw the tweets, blast the tone that had been set in this country, and this was in response to the shootings. But you'll notice that the picture that they put up there is of Trump and Doug Jones. In other words, they're trying to draw you in with a story that pits Senator Jones against President Trump. And this is exasperated even more when you read the first line of this article, which says, Senator Doug Jones, without explicitly naming him, seemed to, in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, point the finger at President Donald Trump after 2 weeks after two deadly mass shootings occurred in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio over the weekend. Now, I encourage you to go read it yourself and decide whether you think that I'm being fair or not. But it seems to me, especially when that's the very first line in your article, it's pretty clear that what this is doing is trying to drum up this idea that Doug Jones went after President Trump on this. And I don't think that's an accurate reading. I went through the tweets, and I looked at them myself, and I went through them probably three or four times after reading this and tried to see if I could figure out a way to make Doug Jones talking about Donald Trump in these tweets, and I couldn't figure out a way to do it. And they don't really do a great job of explaining that in this article. Sean doesn't do the it's not his best work. That's the way that I'll say it. He doesn't connect the dots adequately for me to buy into this theory. And so here we have graphic four where Sean actually saw that I actually tweeted, this was my response to Sean's article. So I said, though I'm pretty outspoken critic of Doug Jones and a fan of Sean Ross, I think that it's reading too much into those tweets. There are plenty of legitimate gripes with Senator Jones. There's no reason to put words in his mouth. And by the way, that is an analysis that I stand by. I mean, when it comes to Doug Jones, the guy's called Abortion Jones for a reason. The man voted against a measure that means that we are one of only six countries on the entire earth, and by the way, some of those countries include China and North Korea, that allow full-term abortion all the way up to the moment of birth on a federal level. And so, yeah, there are plenty of legitimate avenues to criticize Doug Jones on, and if you want to know what they are, just look through my video history. I've been incredibly critical of Senator Jones for a number of things, but that's my point. If you want to score political points against Doug Jones, there is no reason to suggest that he's sort of sending a secret dog whistle that only certain people can hear. That what's really going on is that Doug Jones is saying, okay, Trump is really responsible for the shootings. Now, there are Democrats that have said that. And to be honest, for all I know, that was Doug Jones' intent. But I can't prove it. And I see nothing in those tweets that indicates to me that that's what he was trying to say. It seems to me that Doug Jones was actually being sincere. Now, Jones is a political animal. The guy, we just a couple weeks ago played a clip of him saying that even asking, the guy's absolutely an elitist, even asking that he's voting differently than his constituents would want is a dumb question and it shouldn't even be brought up. So there's no love lost between me and Doug Jones. But on this, I think that he's actually trying to do the right thing, and I don't think it's right to take somebody that's trying to do the right thing and actually succeeding to a great degree in doing the right thing and bashing them over to the head to win political points. I don't think that's the right thing to do. Even when our political adversaries do something that we agree with, it's more important for us then than even if it were something that our political ally said to say, all right, good job, pat him on the back. Now, maybe they wouldn't extend that same courtesy to you, but it doesn't matter. That's the right thing to do. Abraham Lincoln once said, I will stand with any man when he is right. And that needs to be the standard. Let's not make this about personalities. Let's not make this about elections. When somebody says something that is generally true, we say, yep, that's all right. Well done. Because that's where you start moving forward. That's where you find that common ground. And that's also an indication to the other person that you mean them no harm. That when you are arguing against them, it's not personal. It's about their ideas, not about them, not about winning an election. And that's why it is so incredibly important to, when we have these moments where somebody that we do not consider on our side, when we have those moments and we have an opportunity to extend some goodwill to them, it makes them more apt to listen to our criticism in the future because they know we're not attacking them for the sake of attacking them. And so I think that Sean Ross, though well-intended, made a pretty big misstep in saying this about Senator Jones. But I do believe in people having a chance to respond and talk about it. So Sean actually tweeted back at me today And here's that tweet. Not putting word in his mouth, using the context of what he has said in depth on the topic recently. Senator Jones has painted the president as being most responsible for the country's divide, which he is now in turn saying has contributed to the shootings. Now, this tweet does add a little bit of context, not necessarily to Jones, but to Sean Ross and his line of thinking and the way that he arrived at this conclusion. Now, I still think that that's a pretty big stretch. And by the way, the article that he posted there, I want to read a line from it that seems to be what he was pointing to. He said, "The biggest problem I see right now is that the president," this is Doug Jones speaking in that article that he's referring to. "The biggest problem that I see right now is that the president simply uses his Twitter account and says things that are simply not true. And he uses that as a weapon for political reasons. And he's really divided this country a lot." Now, I 100% believe that context matters. I am a fan of context. But there is a difference in context and digging something up for the sake of digging it up. And I think that that's what Yellowhammer News is doing here. That they're trying to find a story, they want a story that pits Senator Jones against Trump, and they know that that's politically feasible and it's going to get a lot of clicks. And so because of that, they write this story. And I don't think that Sean was even necessarily doing it maliciously, it's just kind of a reflex at this point, because normally that's what you do with Senator Jones. But this is a case where I think that it's unwarranted. And is Doug Jones' statement there correct? I don't think so. I think Jones actually gets it wrong there. I think that the country was already divided, and that's how Donald Trump got elected. See, I consider President Trump an effect, not a cause. Donald Trump being elected was a symbol of how divided we were as a country. He's not the one that caused the division. Same thing with the fight that's been going on, and I've been saying this since Donald Trump came out, even before he secured the nomination as the Republican candidate. When it came to the fight between conservatives and the media, that fight's been going on for decades. But the media keeps acting like it just showed up in 2015. That's the first time that any conservative ever thought, you know, maybe I shouldn't trust CNN and MSNBC and CBS. They act like this is the first time that ever happened in the history of this country. And so, similarly here, what I believe is going on is that Senator Jones is trying to attribute an effect to President Trump really what's going on is he's confusing the cause and effect. Because Donald Trump is just an outcropping of that. So I disagree with that analysis. I think Jones is wrong on that. However, this is not the same thing, especially considering that this statement came out 9 months ago. This is not the same thing that saying, oh, well, President Trump is a divisive person. Well, yeah, that's certainly true. Even if Doug Jones believes that, that does not mean that saying the country is divided and that's the reason that we're having shootings is a one-to-one trip, that it's a straight line between that and, okay, what is really going on is Trump's actually causing this. Like I said, Democrats have said that. And honestly, Doug Jones wouldn't surprise me if he said that, or if that's what he really thinks. But we don't need to be attributing things that he said that he did not say. So I think that probably what happened, I don't attribute any evil motives to Sean. I think that he just got a little bit overzealous. I really think that's all that happened. So I hope you'll take this criticism in the way in which it was intended. But it's so important for us to give our political adversaries grace and the benefit of the doubt when possible, because even though they rarely extend it to us, that's what makes us different than them. It's like the movie Batman Begins, if you've ever seen it, where the final task for Batman to graduate the League of Shadows is that he has to take someone's life. And, of course, Batman has the rule about not killing people. And he refuses to, and he says, mercy is not a trait that your enemies will share. And one of the best lines in the movie, he says, that's what makes it so important. Because it makes me different from them. And that's what I believe is important about our political rhetoric. yes, sometimes it sucks, and sometimes you'll have to give a little bit of grace to people that you know, if it were reversed, would not hesitate to throw you under the bus. But the fact that we need to make this about ideas and not elections and not personalities, that's what makes us different than them. Because so often, on that side, it's all about feelings, it's all about personality, it's all about whether or not you like the guy. I mean, we just went through a news cycle where Trump has said something that Elijah Cummings himself has said, and Bernie Sanders has said, and countless people have said on the left about Baltimore, and all of a sudden it became racist because it was Trump saying it. And they even admitted that that was the reason that they believed it was racist. And so, yeah, I get it. The left usually does not extend that same courtesy to us, but that's the reason that it's so important that we extend that courtesy to them. You see, that's the thing about Christ's teaching and the Golden Rule, is that he didn't say, treat others the way that you would want to be treated as long as they're someone that would do the same for you. No, that's not how that works. You do it to everyone. And so we extend the same courtesy to them that we wish that they would extend to us when these kinds of debates happen. And speaking of spirituality, it's time for the Chaplain's Report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
Chaplain's Report today does come from the book of Judges. And this, I'm not going to lie, I totally pulled a lot of my ideas about this lesson from the sermon I heard yesterday. So we have a brother at Dalrady that was preaching last night, gave a phenomenal lesson on the life of Samuel. Sorry, not Samuel. The life of Samson. Been a long weekend. It's been a lot of work. But gave a lesson on Samson, and even though I'm familiar with the story and could give anybody a summary of it or just help someone understand the basics of it, like so many other Bible stories, you can understand different aspects of the story, different morals that the story is trying to teach, once you really delve into it. And that was something that he did a phenomenal job of this past Sunday night. And if you think about Samson and the kind of life that he lived, there's not a whole lot that's heroic about him. And this was sort of his main point of the whole thing. He's somebody that was very strong, but he also was known really not for his heroic deeds, but more for his vices. The guy certainly had a taste in loose women. I mean, he got caught with a prostitute at one point. He constantly went after Philistine women, not Israelite women, which at that time it was forbidden for the Israelites to intermarry with Philistines. And so he basically did what he wanted, and he had an eye for women that were not reputable, not godly women at all, and for several of them, and didn't seem to be real attached to the idea of marital fidelity in a number of different ways. He also cheated people with a riddle that only he could solve and actually bet on it. So he was a philanderer and a cheater. And when people displeased him, when they did something that he didn't like, it was not uncommon for him to kill people. For example, the people that caught him with the prostitute. And in one point, actually burned the crops of the Philistines, burned up people's food. So in a lot of ways, Samson is kind of the villain for most of the story. I mean, the vast, vast majority of the story. And at the end of his life, he did do something kind of selfless, kind of heroic. But it was also somewhat motivated by revenge. Because, of course, we know that what happened to Samson is that Delilah tells the Philistines the secret of his strength. They cut his hair. He's no longer superhumanly strong. And so they bind him and they gouge his eyes out and torture him and he's being held there in a temple. And so finally, he prays that the Lord would restore his strength to him just for a little bit, and he dies in destroying the temple. But even then, his motives for doing so are at least partially motivated by revenge and his hatred for the people that have wronged him. Not so much he was doing it for the sake of Israel or to please God, but more because he wanted to take vengeance on those that had wronged him. And so there's really not a whole lot heroic about Samson's life. And you know, it's so funny, I've often wondered, because I'm kind of a superhero nerd, as anybody that's been listening to me for a while knows. I've often wondered why God didn't allow us to have some kind of abilities, you know, like mutant powers with the X-Men or the Inhumans, something like that, that you could occasionally get some kind of superhuman ability. And then I look at the story of Samson, and you kind of understand why God thought that wasn't a great idea. Because one of the, really the only person that we know of that got superhuman strength from God wasn't really a good guy and didn't use it well. And I think part of the reason for that is power is so incredibly intoxicating. And people can do a lot of bad with it. And they're more apt to do bad with it specifically because they have that power, which is intoxicating and tends to corrupt people. And so I think that's a big part of the reason that we don't have supernatural powers like Samson did. And in the case of humanity, think about this. We have made an incredibly imperfect world. And you look at just recently that with the power that human beings do have, the power of technology, the ability to make weapons like firearms, look at the horrible things that some people have done with that power. Can you imagine what it would be like if people were as supernaturally strong as Samson, who could kill 1,000 people in one fight? I mean, think about how incredibly horrific that would be if you just got one person like Samson who didn't have upright morals and still had that ability. Imagine if there were a lot of people like that. So I think that the Lord is very wise in doing this, but this really brings me to a culmination of where the lesson was going. And this comes from Judges 13, 3 through 5. Then the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold now, you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and give birth to a son. Now therefore be careful not to drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing. For behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistine." So this is the prophecy that the angel gives Samson's mother about his life. And having looked at everything that we just looked at, is any of that not true? He was a Nazarite from the womb, and no razor came upon his head up until the point where Delilah cut his hair and weakened him. And he also did begin to deliver the children of Israel from the Philistines. But what's interesting about that is it was largely unintentional. Samson didn't set out to do what God had purposed him to do. He didn't set out to follow God's will to defeat the Philistines, to liberate Israel from their control. In fact, he intermarried with the Philistines and seemed to spend an awful lot of time with them. And it wasn't until Samson, in his own selfish rage and vengeance, took it out on the Philistines for his own purposes, that started to take place. But the point is, it took place nonetheless. That God used Samson in a very specific way, that even though Samson's designs and will did not align with God's, God was still able to use him to serve his greater purpose and to help those that were innocent, the people that should have been helped by somebody like Samson. God was still able to make that a reality. And the more I thought about it, in a lot of ways, Samson kind of reminds me of President Trump. somebody that was loose with women, that was kind of noted for having some shady deals and some shady connections, and was not someone that anybody should really uphold as some kind of moral leader. And by the way, don't take this the wrong way. I'm not saying that people should vote for President Trump because he's Samson and we need to say, I'm not saying any of that. So don't take what I'm saying out of context. I'm just saying that there are a lot of similarities that even though Trump is by no means somebody that I think that people should want as a leader, you look at some of the effects that he has caused, even though I don't think that he really believes that he's some kind of dyed-in-the-wool Christian that believes in these things that are right, that sort of as a side effect, and I think partially through divine providence, look at the way the church is right now. We're finally actually making some headway when it comes to the issue of abortion. Christians are starting to wake up and realize that their faith is really under attack. And by the way, you could say the same thing about President Obama. He too caused a lot of Christians to wake up and realize that's what was going on. And so even bad leaders, even leaders that I don't think that God would necessarily want or think is ideal, can still be used for God's purpose. A very flawed individual that even though they're not acting in God's best interest is still served by them. But really where I want all of this to hit home and the message that I think that we can take from it in our personal lives is how much better would Samson be if he just did what God asked him to? Granted, Samson sort of inadvertently did an awful lot of good, but how much more useful could Samson have been if he had stayed away from the women that he wasn't supposed to be with, had played fair and been honest and been a morally upright person? Because you think about that, even though goodness knows he had his flaws too, you compare somebody like Samson as a leader to somebody like David. David certainly had his moral failings, but he did repent and he tried to do the right thing. And even though he didn't have supernatural abilities like Samson, he did a lot more good for Israel. Samson, with all of his abilities, all of his potential, chose not to do what God asked him to do. God was still able to use him, but how much more good could he have done if he had stayed on God's side? And how much more do you think God would have been able to bless him and establish him to where he wouldn't have had to go through a lot of the stuff that he went through to be able to serve that end goal? You see, this is not an excuse to welcome evil into your life. I mean, if you were an Israelite at this time, you don't welcome a leader that is as immoral and wicked as Samson. But I do think that it's important for us to realize that we're going to serve God either way. No matter what choices we make, no matter what we do, whether we are a faithful Christian from the time of accountability to the time that we die and serve him to the best of our ability, or the exact opposite, even if we actively work against his will, eventually all things do work together in concert for God's plan. The question is, what side of that battle do we want to be on? Do we want to be an intentional force for good, or a force of evil that God is able to make good come out of? Because those are our only options. We're going to serve him either way. It makes a lot more sense to serve him intentionally and to avoid the kind of problems that Samson had on this side of eternity and probably in the next as well. Stay the course, friends.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.